The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Melanie Katzman. Dr. Katzman is a business psychologist, advisor, and consultant to the world's top public and private companies, as well as governmental and nonprofit institutions. She founded Katzman Consulting in 1999 and has worked with businesses including Accenture, Bain Consulting, Goldman Sachs, MTV, PwC, and Viacom in 31 countries. She is also a founding partner of the global social enterprise Leaders Quest, which serves a community of 12,000 members and facilitates cross-sector strategic discussions on pressing economic and social problems. Melanie was a senior fellow at the Wharton School's Center for Leadership and Change Management and was on the faculty of Weill Cornell Medical School for 25 years. She has a new book. It's called Connect First, 52 Simple Ways to Ignite Success, Meaning, and Joy at Work. Melanie Katzman, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Kelly.
I love how you begin the preface of the book. You write, quote, "Corporate life assumes a convenient fiction. If we assign roles and responsibilities, create flowcharts and project plans, and delineate deadlines and deliverables, then somehow, magically, coolly and calmly, all the work will get done." But that is actually not how it works, right?
Not at all. Not at all.
How does it work?
It works is that we are, you know, flesh and blood, heart-beating human beings who bring ourselves to work whether or not people want to acknowledge that. And in, you know, today's society, there's all this conversation around having meaning-driven workplaces and having passionate employees. Well, passion and meaning and motivation are all heated emotional responses to the work that we're doing. And I think too often people think you walk into the office, step into a role, and step out of your own skin. And that just isn't how it goes.
Yeah, I loved this book very, very much, in part because you must mention at least 15 to 20 guests who've been on the podcast.
Great.
Including a partner of ours, a collaborator, which is Nick Epley at the University of Chicago, because Second City has a partnership with the Center for Decision Research at Booth that looks at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And you quote Nick about the fact that people read each other's minds incorrectly. And that's one of the emotional problems we have, is that we're so assured of our point of view, and so often our point of view is actually wrong.
Absolutely. And what an interesting collaboration. I'm delighted to hear that, because I often tell people, and I just came from Brazil, I was on a panel with him, that my professional muse and mentor is a professional clown.
Yeah.
That the two of us both go into businesses. He helps businesses, so do I. But we identify the absurdity of certain things that people believe to be true, but we actually know they're not. So this, you know, humor, the ability to kind of turn things inside out and to see things as they really are, is so important. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that we read people's minds incorrectly. I also think we have conversations in our head.
Yes.
With ourselves.
Yes.
And we're not always the best conversational partners.
No.
And so we end up kind of creating a belief system in our own internal environment without ever going out and getting the data, testing what we believe to be facts, and really coming to a shared reality with the people we work with.
I should also note that I did book you for the podcast before I read the book, and was delighted that on page 130 you mentioned Yes And, which is the title of my book.
I thought that was why you booked me on this show.
Yeah, well, you know, who knew? Happy accidents. But yeah, this, you know, another term we use around the way you're contextualizing that is we talk about the need to seed the need to be right. And yes and really is that sort of mindset that allows for things to happen when you're not trying to control every aspect of the narrative.
Yep. I mean, and some of the things that people have reacted to when they have read the book has been that I talk about inaction as an action, that sometimes we need to purposely stop and not do anything. Because jumping to an answer, jumping into action, jumping to a conclusion is just that. We're jumping. It's not actually a considered response. So slowing it down, thinking about the alternatives, putting in a punctuation mark is really critical.
Yeah, I mean, Adam Grant has some research, right, around that with this idea of allowing yourself to daydream.
Every procrastinator I know loves those pieces.
Yeah, they do. But I got to be honest, I found that really, so I've done a number of TEDx talks, and the very first one that I did, I scripted. And even though I've worked in theater my whole life, it's not been on stage. And I'm a better improviser than I am memorizer because I went up on my lines and I improvised fine. They didn't know. But then I was talking to Adam about this, and he's like, look, you know your stories. Just sit with your stories, tell it and beat it out in your mind. And I think you're going to have an easier time. And ever since then, every talk I give, and I do this like multiple times a week, I am improvising. But I'm not improvising out of whole cloth because none of us really do that. It's a matter of like being sort of content and calm with ourselves, know that we know our stuff, and then just sort of tell the tale.
It's 100% true. It's my experience as well,
which
is I think about what it is that I want to communicate. I make some notes. I set my intention. But if I actually script it out, I become limited by the script and I'm more focused on getting it right as opposed to actually getting the message across. And I think the more we overscript, the underperforming happens. So I take your advice and Adam's, and I share the same experience.
Yeah. Okay, you talk about civility in the workplace, and we've had Christine Porath on the show, because we do have a problem in the modern workplace, and that's when efficiency gets in the way of civility.
Absolutely, and you know, the work in Connect First builds on Christine's excellent research and her books and talks about this very topic. I mean, we take the basics for granted, and unfortunately, we flub them too often. And so when people say to me, how come you started a book with a smile and then went into please and thank you? Like, do you really have to tell people that? And the answer is, yes, I really do. And more often than not, when people read the book or hear me in coaching, remind them, they go, right, I'm moving too fast. I am being too efficient and not civil. So this happens, and it's an unfortunate byproduct of today's fast-moving, highly efficient society, and sometimes we just need to invest a minute to say one or two words, like please or thank you or I appreciate what you've done.
Absolutely. I want to talk to you. This is something, it really sparked an idea in my head, and I'm curious about where you land on it, because we've seen the evidence. And I've experienced, I personally, like, I smile at people all the time, and it is it's very effective. And there's all this evidence to back up the need to do that. So we have that. But then you also have this pervasive sexist idea that women need to smile more. And you address a lot of issues around D&I in the book that are very forward thinking and smart. And I wonder, like, how do we live with both those things? This idea that we know the evidence is to smile more, but we also know that there's this cultural aspect that can be kind of gross and terrible.
Right. So in the book, I really wanted to be careful to say, on the one hand, smiling is a neural ignition key. It gets people activated. If you want to connect with someone, biologically, we can't resist a smile. So you want to have that in your toolkit. But equally, you want to be able to use it like any other tool, effectively and in the right places. So I wanted to caution women in particular who have been coached to, you know, kind of be pretty and smile. To not see this as a superficial or sexist reminder, but more actually an invitation to use something at their disposal when it feels right for them.
Okay, that works. I was also, you talk about the need to actually memorize or pronounce someone's name correctly.
Yes.
And Dolly Chugg, who wrote The Person You Mean to Be, has a whole section on the evidence behind the corrosive effects of not learning someone's name, or actually even worse, creating a nickname because it's seemingly too hard for you to pronounce. So talk to us a little bit about that, because I think that's a really important, actionable thing that people can do in the workplace that would make things better.
Yeah, thanks for asking me about that, Kelly, because knowing someone's name is so important, and actually using it correctly and pronouncing it, even if it is foreign to your tongue, is really important. It's a show of respect. Our names recognize our individual identity. They say, I see you, I acknowledge who you are, and without a name, you're allowing somebody to move into the shadows. So a name activates the individual you're addressing and also honors them. And there's ways in which you can be so undercut by not having your name pronounced. Just last week, I was on a panel, and they introduced the gentleman who spoke before me by Dr. First and Last Name, and they introduced me as Melanie.
Hmm.
So I've been doing this for a long time, and so it's hard to throw me, but I still felt that sting of, well, wait a second, I have a PhD, I've been Dr. Melanie for 30 years.
Sure.
How come I don't get, why don't I get a credential, and why don't I get a first and last name? So there's ways that we actually undercut people by not using a name correctly that then actually silence them, make them insecure, or undermine their performance. And so you don't know what has transpired in those moments inside when somebody hasn't been called properly, but I can tell you that there's a really good chance if someone's name isn't used properly, they're not feeling great, they're getting distracted, and they're not doing their best.
And they don't feel seen, right? And we know this
No.
from the behavioral science work that we crave as human beings the ability to be seen. And in some of the studies, it talks about, like, I don't even need you to see me as, like, my greatest self. I want you to see me as I see myself. And you write in the book, quote, unfortunately, the privilege of being seen is not equally distributed in organizational life. It's just not, right?
No, and one of the sections, so the book is divided into seven sections, and the second section is about using your senses. And the first chapter is see everybody. Don't just see the people who you think are important. I mean, I have seen it over and over again that people walk into a meeting, acknowledge those individuals they see as decision makers or familiar faces, and pretend that the other people aren't there. And to do that is to really devalue your colleagues. So I encourage people to see everyone that's in the room, including everyone that's in the hall. When you walk in to work, do you say hello to the janitor, to the person who's serving your coffee? Are you saying hello to the parking attendant? Even better, calling them by name, making eye contact, and smiling. It's just quick moments, but they do establish a sense of respect and appropriate warmth between people.
I got a LinkedIn message the other day, and this was so lovely. And it was a former intern. She's like, you probably don't remember me, but about 4 years ago or 5 years ago, I was an intern. I sat outside your office, and I just remember you always said hi to us every day and stopped and chatted, and it meant so much to me. And I'm like, oh wow. I mean, like, it actually, that stuff has just immeasurable impact, especially when it's a senior person dealing with someone sort of new or even an intern. And the stuff you get back, I mean, I was talking about this with my boss, where we've got this new really cool project that all came because he was nice to an intern who had a brother who was connected at this organization we wanted to work with. And it was like, and it's not even that you should do it because you're going to get something out of it. Just do it and the good stuff just follows.
You said it perfectly. And also, when you get those letters, you know, years later, you realize how powerful those moments are. And everyone talks about, again, this importance of having meaning. Well, meaning doesn't happen magically. It happens in those moments. And we can all make meaning and make those magical moments. But it takes a little bit of attention, not a ton, just a little bit. And then it becomes natural. I'm sure for you, it's more natural to say hello to people sitting outside your office than other people. But it can be trained. It can be learned.
Yeah. And it is not natural for everyone. I have many, many people who are, you know, whether it's their introversion or they're thinking about something else, they just don't do it. You talked about meaning and purpose. I really love this line that you wrote where you say, quote, we live in a world where I win, you lose is old news. Our success and survival are interdependent. And this is just, It is so crucial because what we do understand now is that we sort of we live and die by connection, and we have to maintain our connections. And that but that is not the mentality we grew up with in the models that we saw in culture on TV and film about what it means to succeed at business.
Absolutely. And that's part of the retraining of, first and foremost, our own mindsets.
Yeah.
Because you can control your own perspective before you can control somebody else's. So if we shift our mindset to thinking about myself and, you know, you talk about yes and, mm-hmm. me and who else? Who else needs to be in this meeting? What other voice do I need to listen to? Who else can I invite in? And we live in this very transparent and overly competitive world in which you can see the moves that everybody is making. And it can create either a sense of fear, which means we close down our minds, we close our doors, and we try to kind of hunker down, or it can trigger, if we train ourselves, to open up, to be receptive to other people and to be inclusive. And I think it is very much a change from the way many of us were trained, but I think it's also contagious. When you've been the recipient of that kind of collaboration, you see how effective it is, and you're more likely to do it with the next group of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And another myth we grew up with, I think, is this idea around work-life balance. And that also leads to this idea that, you know, your personal values and your work values, maybe you thought in the past that those were going to be separate, but that's increasingly not the case.
Right. I mean, they never should have been, but now there's no place to hide. So I think that, you know, there's a lot to be that people are debating about the pros and cons of social media. But one thing we know for sure is that if you don't want to see yourself in a compromising position, don't be in it. Right. Because people are going to hold you accountable in ways that you never were held before. And that can be a really good thing. And, you know, the opportunity that people have to use work as a lever for social change or positive impact is great. And to say, I'm going to work really hard but be a real jerk and then leave and go and do my community service, and somehow one balances out the other, it just, not only does it not make sense, it exhausts us, and it doesn't take advantage of the capacities that we have.
So so you've been out and about probably promoting the book and doing different interviews, right?
I have, in fact.
All right. How many people want to talk to you about the chapter where you talk about people touching each other at work? I'm assuming everyone.
A lot of people do, including, by the way, my agent and my editor, who are like, really, Melanie?
I bet.
What?
I loved that chapter. I mean, it's in, I don't know, do you know the research that was done by Michael Krauss, I believe it was, who did the NBA, he like studied the NBA players who touched each other on the court?
Yeah.
This stuff was great because, I mean, literally the person who touched the most people was Kevin Garnett in his MVP year. And the team, the Boston Celtics that year, had the highest touch. And there is tons of it. This is you're citing evidence, which is, you know, in fact, the people who touch each other more tend to form these sort of quicker bonds and they're more connected and they trust each other. And that is not to say that we have free reign to touch each other. You talk about that in the chapter. But it is something that we shouldn't ignore.
Right. And by the way, with the football players, we should be saying that these are not tackles. These are touches, right?
Yeah.
And so, and touch, one of the greatest findings in the touch research is that if you touch somebody lightly between the elbow and the shoulder, that gains compliance, communicates trust, and calms people down. So think about that. That's just a light tap on somebody's arm that isn't a bear hug. It isn't picking somebody up who's smaller than you and moving them to another place. It's not necessarily, and probably shouldn't be, kissing somebody unless you have a different kind of relationship. So when I talk about touch, I talk about that moment where you just make a quick connection with a light tap on somebody's arm. If you know, feel moved in certain situations to want to perhaps give a hug to somebody, you ask first, right? But this is not about being sexualized at work. This is about being human at work. And there are people, as we know, in societies that are called the untouchables. Mm-hmm. So to really avoid someone, to not shake their hand if their hand is outstretched, is such an insult. We never want anyone to feel like they are untouchable.
So we have a tradition at Second City that we've done as long as I've been there, which is 31 years, which is before you go out on stage together or before you lead a workshop together, everyone goes to everyone else, taps them on the back and says, I've got your back.
Love it. Love it. So my team, what we do is right before we start a program or go into a facilitation for a company, is we just check in with everybody and go, what do you need to shine? And we just whiz around really quickly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes somebody will just say, you know what, my throat is sore, and please just make sure that you speak more than me. And it could be very tactical. You know, and somebody else might just say, give me a thumbs up if I'm on the right track. Or someone else will just say, just make sure I have a glass of wine when I'm finished. But it's, you know, just that quick check-in to say, again, I see you, I'm here with you, we're in it together.
And one of the things you're also doing, and this is Jane Dutton at University of Michigan has done work in this area around suffering at work, which is, you know, we work is pretty terrible normally about dealing with suffering. But one of those things, if you're in a meeting and you are like your big toe hurts, by announcing that to the room, you're not only letting other people know, but you've decreased your burden of just focusing on this thing that's going to take your attention away.
Well, that's such a great example, and I think her work is so important because, in fact, we often, the higher up you are in the power ladder, the more people read everything you do with incredible detail. So you're having a bad day, your stomach hurts, you had a fight with your spouse before you came in. Nothing to do with the people around you, but they're watching you, and they're trying to decode what's going on and think, oh, my God, Kelly's not happy with the work I did. What did I do wrong? Let me go back and check. And you're like, what? There's nothing to do with it. I just ate a heavy lunch, and my stomach is hurting. So sometimes being able to label what's going on actually eases not only your pain, but the pain of the people around you who are trying to figure out, am I in trouble?
100%. So someone once said, I forget who said it, but I love it. They said, you know, all business problems or any business problem is probably a communication problem. And I think broadly speaking, that's true. I love this thing that you talk about in the book, and I want you to explain why saying got it in response to someone's email is actually really hugely important.
So got it are the two most important words, I think, at work. Please. Thank you. And then let's say got it.
Yep.
And got it assures somebody that there's actually a living, breathing human on the other end of that email or text or phone call that you placed. And what happens is that we send people a request or we send a finished product, and it goes off into the ether. We don't know whether somebody's going to respond to us, whether, in fact, it's been received. And when you're trying to either get validation that your job has been well done or that your request is being processed, the absence of got it leaves you in this void in which we most of the time then fill with negative, like, I'm not important enough.
Yeah.
Obviously, somebody else's work is getting priority. I can't leave the office because I don't know whether or not the answer I need is going to come through. I can't finish my report. So people who are at the senior level get frustrated when their subordinates aren't letting them know that they're working on their work. And equally, people who are waiting for their bosses don't know what's going on without getting some indication. And got it is quick. I know people are afraid that it's going to fill their email boxes and say, oh, why should I add something extra? I think it's worth the investment. You can say, read the got it and then delete it.
Exactly.
Just assures you.
It's like a dopamine hit almost. And I was thinking about, like, what is the worse thing than not getting a got it? Is it nothing? And I go, no, it's not worse. It's when you send someone a work text and then you see those little buttons, you know, the little round things that they're typing, but then nothing ever comes through. You're like,
right,
well,
right.
What?
Exactly. And, you know, if you want extra credit, I say, you can say, got it? And then I will get your answer to you by this time. I mean, that's like the bonus round, right? Which is, I know what you want me to get, but actually it's going to take me some time to do it. But I'll do it, and here's when you can expect my answer. That helps people manage themselves and their time. And the other thing I talk about in the book is the importance of giving people control over time as a way of not only showing respect, but increasing their efficiency and, quite frankly, their loyalty.
There's other stuff to unpack in the communication area that I want to talk about because I think it's important and it's things that people gloss over. So one of the things, it's funny, you touch on so much around improvisational pedagogy without, I think, maybe knowing all about this stuff. But
I want to learn more.
Yeah. So one of the things that is elemental in early improv training is that we are teaching people to be intentional with your focus. That's what you're doing with improvisation. You're creating these exercises where they have to, very often it's just removing the focus from ourselves to being others focused, but then focused with intent. So, you know, when you play the games differently, these different exercises, and shift your focus, very different things happen. And I want to unpack a little bit about that, because I don't think people understand that the power of a focus shift or a different intent of focus can completely change the course of a conversation.
Absolutely. And I think that comes from either how you frame it with the people you're meeting with, or how you frame it in your own mind, and literally the perspective that you take. So if I walk into a meeting with the intention that what I really want to do is just argue my point, I'm probably not going to be able to hear what you're saying or collaborate on a unique solution. So if I set my intention of, Kelly's got something I need to learn in the course of this next meeting, this could be a very different outcome than I'm coming in saying, we are negotiating on opposite sides of a deal.
Yep.
It's just going to be more. It's going to be more hostile. It's going to be a more limited discussion, and there's a greater probability that the facts that need to be surfaced will not come up to the point that they need to be.
And then self-knowledge kicks in, because if we know a bit of our status, or we know a bit of how we might be perceived in a room, we can change our behavior to open up the communication. And you quote your colleague, Max Metcalf, saying, you need to manage your muchness. I'm yeah. totally a manage your muchness person. I suspect you are, too.
Yeah, can you tell? I mean, you know, it's very easy for me and my extroverted self to kind of come in and talk and bubble and feel that I'm doing everybody a great service by, you know, filling the room with conversation and energy. But you know what? Sometimes that's not what's called for, and sometimes you need to make space. And for people who have big personalities, and that doesn't necessarily mean a loud personality, but it's one in which you can kind of, you know, fill the space in the room, it's important to have that self-awareness about how is your presence making a difference for people, both negatively and sometimes, hopefully positively, and sometimes inadvertently negatively.
So there's an improv adage which says all of us are better than one of us. You say it a different way. You say, quote, learning together, we get smarter. But I think it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. And actually, on the smarter piece, you know, in the chapter I have on becoming a magnet, be the person people want to be with, I encourage everybody that I work with to leave the people that you've met smarter because of your interaction with them. So come and be generous with your knowledge and your information. So helping others be smarter makes everybody smarter and also makes you a more attractive candidate for projects and jobs.
Yeah, and that level, I think it's also a recognition that we are always co-creators, no matter what we're doing, mm-hmm. and that our mm-hmm. co-creation isn't just the two people in the room. Our co-creation is all the people we grew up with and how we lived our life. Our co-creation also meets out to the audiences who are potentially buying the products we want to sell. So this idea of opening yourself up to sort of listen more generously and to create space for the idea that might be surprising to you. This is not how human beings are wired. We have to make room to practice to get better at this.
Well, so actually, we are wired to connect.
We are wired to connect.
Overwired, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the neurobiological data that's coming out, you just look at the functional imaging studies, you see that when the brain is not engaged in like solving the math problem, what gets activated is more of our social seeking and attentiveness behaviors. So I think that our preservation as a species is dependent on our ability to play well and connect well with others. And so we are wired to connect. We synchronize our heartbeats and our breathing when we're with other people if we pause. What happens is we run quickly and override that.
Mm.
So in some ways, I feel that the book is sharing data and examples to bring us back to where we were when we came out of the box before we put in all of these, you know, new attributes that we developed over the course of our lifetime. I think actually we came out wired to connect, and then we end up kind of undoing that through the course of the experiences that many people have at work.
Yeah, that's true, and it's and I you know, I wonder if that's also because of moving, you know, into urban environments, and you know, and now you've got the challenge of digital environments, and you've got your coworker you might never actually even meet in person, and you know, more and more we're going to be interacting with screens and robots and and AI, and you look at all the data and the ideas around the future of work and the qualities that the workforce is going to need are those things that make us most human and messy and narrative, right? Telling stories and solving problems.
Exactly. So, you know, people are so afraid of AI and the robots. I'm like, actually, they're going to help us be more human. That is our unique contribution to the workforce. If it's just simple computation, let the computer or the robot do it. So the land of imagination and creativity and warmth and emotion, that's what we as humans have. And I think that we are being challenged to reconnect to that during this time of technology. You know, and something you said, Kelly, about us not being co-located with our workers is really important, and it's another motivation for writing the book. Because how do you create a connection to somebody that you may never see? You know, like one of the examples I gave in the book is that I asked people on a conference call, just very quickly, go around and tell me, what do you see out your window?
Mm.
That just locates people truly in space. You get a sense of, oh, wait, I forgot. This person is on their holiday, but they're taking this conference call at 7 in the morning. They're on a beach, but they are on the other side of the world. And somebody else is on a farm, and someone else is in the middle of an urban environment. And somebody's working out of their kitchen, and someone's in the office. And just going quickly like that, it doesn't take a lot of time, but it gets everyone's voices out and gives you a sense of who the person is and what their environment is like.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast. But before we do that, this is an unusually put together book. And I say that positively and with admiration, because you have 52 chapters, and these are like quick chapters that load in. You have the evidence almost with every single one, and then you got tips and you have examples. And I'm wondering, like, when you were going in to write this, did you have the format in mind, or did the format reveal itself when you realized how you tell your stories?
So to know me is to know that I am an organized person to a fault.
Okay.
So I tend to organize my ideas in bullet points and then supporting evidence.
There
you go. That's my natural wiring. Mm-hmm. But the motivation for the book came when I was a co-host on I had a radio show for a while, Women at Work, on Sirius. And one of my guests asked me what book I wanted to write. I said to him, well, what book do you want to read? And he said, well, what have you learned as a psychologist and a coach working in this unique position of a therapist and then also a corporate advisor, and often in the same day? And I said, what I learned is everybody is the same. You just peel back the skin a drop and you see tremendous similarity, and that I teach and learn the same lessons over and over again. It's just not that hard. And he goes, I want to read that book.
Yeah.
I got on the subway and I started writing things down.
Mm-hmm.
I got back to my office and I made an index card for each one. And that's how it started. And then I thought, I want this book to be really usable. I'm an academic. I read constantly. And I find that just the words on the page become off-putting after a certain point when you can't find what it is you need to do unless you dig in and highlight it. So I wanted something that people would use, reuse, share, put a bookmark in, give it to a colleague, say, this is the chapter you need to read. You know, the book follows a narrative arc, but it's also set up that you could kind of dip in like a bunch of different tapas plates and eat what you want and as much as you need and then come back for more. So I was very purposeful from the start that I wanted this to be usable, to be different, to take the academic knowledge and make it accessible so that people could learn quickly and just put it into action right away.
Yeah, because having worked with all my friends at the University of Chicago and now done stuff at Stanford and UCLA, you know, the rigorous researchers are very wary of bullet pointing anything, but they also have the best stuff that really needs to get in the hands of the population who need to understand it, you know, through story and through the idea. And you do a really good job of, you know, bringing those ideas to life without cheapening them or sort of Malcolm Gladwelling them, where you make it like, that's not quite what the point was. And I think the brevity actually helps you with that, like getting right to it.
Thank you so much. I wanted to call it like the No Excuses Manual. Like,
right.
This is something you can use at any point in your career that you can reference back, that it's a shared language for people, and that I could say, do this right now. Put the book down and just send a two-line text to someone to say thank you for something they did yesterday. Mm-hmm. I am sure that you can find one person who did something that you appreciate. So I wanted it to be actionable, and then I, you know, put in a section called Keep in Mind. Right. So also, here's just a way you might get tripped up. So let me try to open your eyes to potential misuse in case there's any questions. So try to be sensitive to the busy person who needs their answer fast, doesn't want to spend money, doesn't want to spend time, but just wants to feel better and do better.
All right. We're going to ask you for a yes and story. So we do this with every guest. And in the parlance of improvisation, we have groups of people who are making something out of nothing. And we have learned that you get nowhere by saying no. And you actually don't get very far by just saying yes, right? That doesn't move the needle at all. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if there's a time in your life or your work when you normally would have said no, but instead you didn't stop at yes. You actually said yes and.
Okay. So there actually, several years ago, I had just published another book, and I had also just redone my office. We had recently moved into a new apartment that we had also just fixed up. My son had gotten into the school that we wanted him to go to for kindergarten. Everything was lining up. And then my husband and I got an opportunity to go to Hong Kong for our work life.
Mm.
It was like, what? This is nuts.
Yeah.
But there's nothing about what's set up in our life currently that we work so hard to put into place that would suggest that this is the time to say yes to an offer to move to Hong Kong. And we looked at each other and said, we have to say yes.
Hmm.
So our bodies are saying, no, no, this is going to be really difficult. But we knew in our hearts that we had to say yes. And that once we said yes, we had to commit to really going and making this an adventure for us and for our family. And I can tell you that our lives professionally and personally would never be what they are today had we not made that initial yes. And then yes, and we're going to, you know, throw ourselves into the community that we find and make friends and treat this as it's going to be our home, even though we knew it would probably be, you know, a temporary residence.
So this has had to be kind of a tough few weeks for you, sort of, or months for you, watching what's happening there.
Yes, very, very difficult, and a lot of my friends and colleagues are suffering, no matter what their political perspectives are, because it isn't a comfortable or happy time to watch the dismantling of a really wonderful society as it's trying to figure out how to move into the future in a way that satisfies so many different constituents. Sorry.
Well, yeah. That's fine. I mean, you know, and that is just final thought. I mean, I think, you know, a thing at work needs to do is acknowledge the societal issues and cultural issues going on. I mean, we're living at it's a very toxic time, you know, reading the newspaper for a variety of people in a variety of different ways. And it's not like we go to work and all that stuff disappears, especially because of social, because many of us use social at work. So suddenly you're watching the next big thing blow up on Twitter. And then, you know, it's very hard to then get back into your rhythm of like, okay, now I'm going to be happy and do good work.
Well, and to your point, you just asked me, you heard I lived in Hong Kong, you asked me about the effect it has on me. When I write to my colleagues in Hong Kong, for me not to acknowledge the news that's going on around them would be so cold. It doesn't mean we're going to get distracted and have a whole political discussion, but it does mean I'm recognizing that they may not be in a situation that felt anything like the way they lived before. And so to ignore it would, I think, be really cold. To go down a path that maybe more than anybody wants to explore would be equally insensitive. But I think we have to just pay attention to the fact that people live and exist in environments that make a difference in their behavior. And if we don't pay attention to that, again, we're devaluing the relationship and the person that we want to work with and care about.
The book is called Connect First, 52 Simple Ways to Ignite Success, Meaning, and Joy at Work. Dr. Melanie Katzman, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumblebear, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fain. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. I'm taking this one.
survive.